Welcome to Men Are Nuts, a podcast about mental health, emotional health, psychological health, physical health awareness in men, women, and society. First, it started with MAN, the acronym for Men Are Nuts. That's a long introduction. And we have a very special guest on the show for you today. She's based in the UK. We've had a talk before, and like I say, it's my first time meeting her. And let's go. Introduce yourself.
Hi, Andy. My name's Rohana. It's so lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes. And what did you say? Your name was Rohana?
Sorry, no, Rihanna.
Rihanna. So Rohana. Yeah, Rohana. That's... what? Where are you from? And the name Rohana, where's that come from?
It's an Arabic name as far as I know. My parents come from Kashmir, which is sort of occupied by India and Pakistan and China. It's an Arabic name.
Yeah. And where are you based?
In Birmingham in the UK.
I noticed just then, before we were speaking, I didn't hear anything. I could hear her, but I couldn't hear an accent. That's what I'm getting at. Then all of a sudden, as soon as she said Birmingham, I heard the Birmingham accent.
It's the way you're supposed to say it.
So we was talking, just to let the listeners know, I mean, obviously this is not live, but to let listeners know, we was talking maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes before the podcast, and it's just about me letting them know about me, and I didn't hear it, not once. So to hear it all of a sudden now, can you give them another snippet of the Birmingham accent?
It comes as it comes. I can't do accents,
So we, are you originally from Birmingham? Are you from there? Are you born there?
No, I was in London till I was four.
Right.
And I guess I learned to talk there. And then I moved back.
Right.
but I'm Brummy. I am.
Right. So you actually see yourself as a Brummy then now, because you've been there so long.
Yeah, but I consider myself as kind of, I guess, a Londoner because I have roots in both. I'd say equal amount of time in both, but yeah, it's my heart as well, you know. So I'm a Brummy.
How are things in Birmingham anyway? How are things in Birmingham at the moment? And, you know, what's... In fact, before we go on, to let listeners know, where is Birmingham? Where is it? You know, because I've got listeners from all over the world. So where is Birmingham? And obviously it's in the UK, but whereabouts in the UK? And can you tell us a bit more about Birmingham?
Yeah, it's middle England. It's right in the middle. It's the heart of the country. It's the second city. It's still in development. It's always been, you know, ever since I remember, there's always been stuff going on. But I suppose that's in London as well.
Yeah.
And other parts of the UK. It's the heart of the country, and it's, yeah.
Near Shakespeare County, Warwickshire.
Yeah, I see that road sign every time I'm driving around. It's near there as well.
Yeah. What's it like to live there? What's it been? I mean, I know you're from there, and you might have some favourites or bias or whatever it may be, but what's it like to live there?
It's not that different from London and I guess any other major city in the UK. It's, you know, since things have opened up again, it's become really busy again.
Yeah.
Noticed it's, you know, traffic and all of that. It's just, it's kind of back to normal.
So Birmingham's it's supposed to be one of the biggest cities?
It's the second biggest city, yeah.
In England. Do you live more rural, or is it more in this towards the city? Does it have the rural side to it, Birmingham?
Yeah, it does. There's a lot of green, right? Like, because I live near Sutton Coalfield, which is, I think, Sutton Coalfield Park is the biggest public park in Europe or something like
really?
That. It's massive.
Really?
Yeah, like if you're driving around, you'll be driving around one side of it or on the other side of it. And there's just a lot of countryside where I'm at. It's not too far.
Yeah, because I will tell this story, but I remember going to years ago when they didn't have the smartphones and having one of those Nokia phones, and I remember being in Birmingham and it was late at night, and because of the spaghetti junction, and I couldn't find the sign. There's obviously no signpost to Nottingham or that way.
Yeah.
And remember, there's a signpost for Sutton Coldfield, and I kept going round and round off the spaghetti junction, off and on, thinking, wait. And then I end up turning off and heading towards Wolverhampton. And I literally only had a map. You know, it's back in the days of having those AA maps, those big AA maps in your car, and no sat nav. And I remember trying to get, and I didn't get home till about 4 o'clock in the morning, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. That's always till that. And that was after leaving about 11, you know, 11 o'clock at night.
So,
driving all the way back from Wolverhampton trying to find my way using this map. But yeah, that's always. But the spaghetti junction is one of the Birmingham famous for?
I'd say the Bull Ring, definitely. Everyone seems to know it, and I don't know if you've been there, but like the Bull, have you? The Bull, people love to take pictures, and it's always like if there's a national event, like a wedding, you know, a royal wedding, it's got like a tuxedo on and different things, Christmas hat, and then there's like the canals. It's got more canals than Venice, apparently.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's down near the canal. I forget. Always forget about that area. Where the what's that area called? Where the canal is? There's an area there's bars and bars. That main street. I've got that street's called. What in Birmingham?
I think it's near Broad Street. What you're talking about?
That's the one, Broad Street.
Yeah, that's known.
Yeah, the main street.
I didn't know this, but when I watched the Peaky Blinders, you know, the canal's connected all the way down to London. You know, they're going down to London over the canal as well. Wow. Yeah.
So it does have Birmingham does have a lot of history then. So obviously it's got the football clubs and
cricket grounds.
Been there as well. Have you had is there anyone famous that's come out of, that you would know of that's come out of? Anyone? I mean, we know that Shakespeare's county, Warwickshire's nearby, but anyone?
Tolkien, Lord of the Rings.
Really?
Very, very close. And you know the book, there's so many sort of places in the book that were based on sites in Birmingham.
Wow. That's fascinating.
So, and I love Tolkien. My favourite book is The Silmarillion, which was like the prequel to Lord of the Rings. Wow. And that's a bit of pride for us, I guess.
When I say I'm doing this podcast and I'm learning about people and learning about things, that's, you know, you've told me, there's quite a few things that you've told me there about even Birmingham and the books and stuff and Tolkien. And I didn't know that. I didn't know because I've watched the movies. I remember reading Lord of the Rings years ago in English, in English lessons, but I didn't know that it was in Birmingham. Wow.
Yeah, and like it's cool because when I see those places in Birmingham and around it, you know, I can kind of see how he sort of, you know, his imagination, what it was, you know, he would be sort of at school and he can see something, and that's kind of, he's put that into the book and, you know, exaggerated it, but it's just so cool.
Yeah, you say like life imitating art and imagination. Mm. It's quite fascinating. And now I can probably picture it. And I know Birmingham has a place, the Jewellery Quarter. Is it the Jewellery Quarter?
Yes.
Famous for that. And Cadbury's there.
Yeah.
It's like Cadbury's.
Cadbury, he was from here as well. So Cadbury's comes from Birmingham, but of course it got sold. The Jewellery Quarter, because this was the city of 1,000 trades. It was, you know, there was so much, like the coins, the minting, all of that is coming from the Jewellery Quarter, and some of it probably still does. There's a lot.
Yeah, so fascinating history from Birmingham. So you've lived there. What's, in terms of, you know, you've talked about the thing, but in terms of living there, you know, it's a bustling place. Do you enjoy living?
I do. I love it because, you know, having lived in London as well, I love London as well. But, you know, Birmingham is a bit more sort of relaxed. It's still very busy, yeah. But because, you know, having lived in London and then coming back to Birmingham, it's kind of got everything that London has for me anyway.
Yeah.
And yet it feels a little bit more relaxed. It has become more congested. But it's not on that level, you know, so.
Yeah, so it's not the level of London. And just to let you know, before, because this, I've only got a 40-minute limit on this, so after 10 minutes it
won't. Okay.
So I'll just click on the link again, and then I'll be back in again, so click on the same link. Yeah, so I was going to ask you as well, you know, you alluded to that the place has got back to normality. What's it been like the last two years since, you know, kind of two questions here. What's it been like, and where were you kind of where were you and what were your thoughts at the time when it kind of all started, this the pandemic and all that?
I remember when it kind of hit, I think it was like late November, December time, when me and my husband, we were in Holland for his job, because his company was based there, and we were there for his work, and then we were kind of sent back early, because, you know, borders were going to close apparently.
Right.
And they were like, you have to go back because you'll get stuck and then you'll be in a hotel for we don't know how long and all of that. So we had to go back abruptly, and that was kind of weird because that's never happened, you know.
Yeah.
And it was just weird coming back on the ferry, you know.
Excuse me, yeah, sorry.
It was just weird atmosphere, you know, it was kind of quiet and people were sort of still mixing because at that time it was too early, but there was this weird vibe, sort of caution, I don't know. It was unknown, so it was all just kind of, we were learning it as it was coming out, and then since then it's just been weird, you know, all this stuff that's been like the news, and then you have I kind of early on stopped watching the news because of, you know, I just felt like it was it's just kind of blowing everything out of proportion, it felt like to me, and it was just inciting fear in people and, you know, division as well, and I just stopped watching it. I felt so much better than the people that I was talking to who were still watching it. They're just very anxious. And then the panic buying thing happened. That was really kind of sad to see, because I felt like it was a time when we could have really showed our solidarity and how we could sort of, you know, when something happens, a crisis, like we could come together.
Yeah.
But we seemed to be doing the opposite. Like, That kind of base instinct, the animal instinct kicked in, you know, we have to survive, I have to make sure I have my provisions. And the real sad thing is when I spoke to checkout people, they were being like abused, and they were saying things like they had to limit how much of each item people could have, and they'd get abused for that. And then even baby food, like there'd be people buying more than they needed. But then that means someone has to go without.
Yeah, someone's baby has to go out as well.
Yeah. So you've got all this extra, but they've got none.
Yeah.
I thought that was really sad to see. So it's kind of a lot of different emotions, I guess. But I think, and also then there's a vaccine and the anti-vaxxer thing. Like, I really didn't like this whole narrative about anti-vaxxers, quote unquote, you know, who are being demonized because of they want to wait until there's enough information.
Yeah.
You know, I just felt like that should be a choice.
So were you
it was sad to see what was happening in the NHS, this, you know, being forced on and people losing their jobs.
Were you during the last 2 years, did you become fearful? Were you affected by it mentally? I know you kind of come away from the news and stuff like that, but how did it affect your person, you as a person, and you, maybe your relationships or your husband or, you know, people around you? How did it affect you?
Well, I have to say I'm so fortunate that I don't know anyone personally who died as a result of COVID or, you know, underlying conditions because of contracting it as well. I'm lucky to be able to say that. And my family luckily also kind of didn't panic and kept a cool head about the situation. And sort of, it was just good to be around people that, you know, kept a cool head in a situation like that. And so I looked at the statistics of, you know, the recovery rate of COVID rather than the death toll that was being shown on the news every day and increasing day by day. I looked at the recovery rate being very, you know, 99 point something. Yeah. So those things were keeping me grounded, you know, that kind of data, because how is it going to help to start to panic and worry and then release all these anxiety hormones in your body? And, you know, there's just no point in that. So it was about, you know, exercising, doing what I do, just keeping my routine, socializing with people when we could, whether that be by video or when we were allowed to see them, and just going out, you know, walking in the parks or whatever when we were allowed to do that and things like that. So yeah, just taking a measured approach. And I'm glad, looking back now, if I'd done it the other way, what would that have achieved?
Yeah. And during the, and then after, you know, this last year, and things have changed and things are opening, how's it, has it felt like a bit of a relief to you? I mean, was your job intact? What were those side of things like?
It was a relief, you know, to see things going back to normal.
Yeah, yeah.
Just because this has been too long and we've lost so much, I think, when we really think about what we've lost. There's been a lot of things, and some people even see it as kind of like losing a couple of years of their lives. Maybe because of the way they were during that time, and, you know, you could kind of see why that might feel like it. But I don't see it that way. I see it as an experience that's so unique and something I never, you know, never thought would happen in my lifetime.
Yeah, yeah.
I can imagine. You read about stuff like this. So I think it was an experience. And in terms of my job, you know, I did have a job in the NHS, and at one point that was, you know, I was sent an email saying I had to be vaccinated or I couldn't work, and I was working remotely like this, you know, online. And I said that, I said, well, I don't actually see clients face to face. They said, well, this is the government, we're following the government mandate guidelines. And I was willing to leave.
Yeah, yeah.
But it didn't come to that in the end. They retracted it because of other guidance, I guess, or the change in the government, I think. But that happened. And people being harangued and, you know, guilt tripped and sort of told that they're harming or risking other people and things like that. You know, that doctor who, I don't know if you saw, that doctor in the NHS who was, I think he went viral, or he had a lot of viewership, and he was sort of speaking out on it, and he works with patients. He had good reason for what he was saying, but, you know, these sort of mainstream channels were demonizing him because of their narrative.
Yeah. So you've come out of it now. You know things are picked up. Are you obviously relieved and stuff like that, and has your job, has things in your job changed? Have you noticed a change in people over the last two years, or even people that you're close to? Have you noticed a change in I know we've got this thing going off now with people saying people want to stay at home, work from home, and some people have lost there's certain jobs that people don't want to go to because of the of what happened to them and just mental health and stuff like that. So have you noticed a change in Birmingham or of people around you that, you know, different narratives of how the last couple of years have been and how it's affected them, whether it's negative or positive?
I mean, in terms of like my work, I've noticed that people are just happy to go online. People still actually do prefer face-to-face.
Yeah.
Because I work face-to-face as well. I do both. If people could have very good...
Just let listeners know, what do you do?
I'm a psychotherapist. Yeah, so I do have people come in and they prefer face-to-face, but the only ones I see online are the ones that are in other cities.
Right.
So, you know, if they're given the choice, people prefer to come in, and that sort of tells me then that there's not so much of a fear of it. And, you know, many of the clients will cancel because they've got COVID, and then they'll come back and... You know, I've got clients who've had it 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
I've had it once. It's just like, it kind of is our new reality. It's like the flu, you know, we should just expect every year possibly to have it.
Yeah. And what does, for listeners out there that don't know what a psychotherapist is, is your time to shine. Like it has been from the beginning. What's a psychotherapist and what does a psychotherapist do?
Okay, yeah, so I'm essentially trained in psychology, in counselling psychology in particular. So I counsel people long term and sometimes short term as well. It depends, I guess, on the person and their needs. Using psychological theory. But I'm trained in a few different ones, so that's called integrative, and so it depends on what that person needs, what will speak to their psychology at this point in their life, because, you know, the same person might be open to CBT right now, but in the future they might not be, so it's kind of really following closely what that person might need, what might speak to them, what they might respond to, and using the tools in my repertoire from my training, but also being very attuned to this person that's in front of me right now. So I guess in a nutshell, that's what it is.
Yeah, and before we start talking about your past and what, you know, the reason why you're here. We know the reason why we're here, but I mean the reason why you do the job.
Do we know the reason why we're here?
Again, doing. I was about to say, do we know the reason why we're here? What is our calling? I'm kind of guessing what my calling is. I think I've worked it out now after a long time of denying it, and it's obviously working with people and working with children and young people and all that. But in terms of this, you being a psychotherapist, do you have clients? Do people come to you to read? Is it drugs, alcohol? Mental?
I don't know that.
Is it mental health? What is it?
Yeah, it's mental health. That can relate to different things. You know, it can be to do with addiction. It could be to do with trauma. It could even be coaching. They might have issues in their life now that they want to work on in a practical way. They need kind of some direction. It could be that someone's just been diagnosed with a physical illness, and they, you know, there's psychological element to that gets lost, especially in the NHS where they're, and we can understand it. They're there to do the medical, physical side of things. But they don't necessarily help with the psychological impact of that diagnosis.
So are you assigned? Are you assigned a person within the NHS? Then, because you're not a person that's doing it as for a job as your own as an entrepreneur. So you'd have to get clients. How does it work with the NHS? Are they assigned to you or?
maybe I haven't been clear then. Well, I haven't. I founded my own clinic now.
Right.
So I do work for myself, but I work for a few other private practices. I don't work in the NHS anymore.
Right.
I eventually will be just working in my own clinic because of time constraints. In the NHS you get assigned your caseload. So you always have your clients there, whereas when you work in private practice, there's a lot more pressure to ensure you're doing, a good job, because otherwise if you're not doing a good job, client will go elsewhere to find someone who is.
Right.
Whereas in the NHS, they're going to come through because they've been referred to you. And still people drop out as well in the NHS if they're not getting. Actually, I do have clients who have dropped out of the NHS and they've come to us.
Obviously something that you enjoy doing then.
Something else that I enjoy doing.
I was saying, is it something that you enjoy doing, working with people and yeah. seeing a range of people and talking to them and looking at different things?
Absolutely, this is my passion, it's a real honor, it's a privilege for me. It's just, I couldn't really see myself doing anything else, and if it was something else, it would be in the helping profession. When I've looked back on it, because I knew I wanted to do this before the age of 16, I remember that vividly,
yeah.
and I'm talking about psychology in particular. So it wasn't just this kind of loose and sort of loose sense of helping. I wanted to help with psychology. I remember that, and having reflected on that more, I realize it's because it's about the human spirit and what it's capable of, and how it's just so sad when you see that it's been shut down. For me, it's just to be someone who can help to, bring it up and sort of bring it out in all its glory,
Yeah.
It's just such an honor. And I think in terms of psychology, the reason why I chose psychology rather than another type of helping profession was because I'm so curious and I love learning, and I love intrigue and mystery. I love to be able to sort of work things out, interrogate information, solve problems. And this is what we're doing with people. They are mysteries. I need to know you. I need to be curious and understand what makes you who you are. So that I can use my training and expertise to sort of work with what you're bringing here. And it's just so amazing to see the outcomes, to see that transformation. You see them from what they were to what they've become. And, I'm just moved by it, just talking about it, but it's so special, and I just feel really lucky to be able to have known that I wanted to do it, but also to overcome my own barriers to get to this point to do this.
Yeah, and that kind of leads us nicely on to talking about you and your life, and I was just interested in it because we started the podcast and we were talking, I could feel your curiosity towards what I was saying or what I was going to say. I could feel it, I could pick up on it straight away, because the way you moved and the way you put your head and you're actually attentive and looking, and you were kind of, so I can see how that would work with a client and how you'd be looking and thinking and even analysing, because we do analyse, a baby analyses, the mum's face or the dad's face, looking it down at them. So we can use that word analysing because it's not a bad word. So let's talk about your journey.
Yeah.
your training. What was life like for you when you were younger? You know, school and, you know, as a child. Because I want to kind of let listeners know that you're not this, like you just say, you're not this person that just a random person that just become a, you know, to take on a job on your own in psychology, and there's a journey there. What was your life like when you were younger?
Come from like a big family, and that was nice. Brothers and sisters, you know, we had a lot of fun growing up. But there were things that happened in my life early on that were difficult, that led me to depression. Actually, that when I look at it in retrospect, I think, oh, I was depressed. I think, you know, as I said, I love learning, and I did from a young age. After school, there was a library joined onto that school. I'd go to the library and I'd read for some hours, then I'd go home, because it was just my passion. And then what happened was, I think when I was about 13, going up 14, I was pulled out of school by my parents, predominantly my mum, and taken to Kashmir, where I'd never been. I didn't know the people. They were family, but I didn't know them. And they were sort of, it was a different country. I was homesick straight away, you know. And I got off the plane, it smelled different. I remember that, you know. It's just, it didn't smell bad, but it smelled different. And it's a beautiful country, lovely people, but it wasn't home. And I was a child. And so that disrupted my school, because I was there for almost 10 months at a really critical time in school. And when I got back, I had to go into a different school. And if you think about the schools that would have availability at a critical point, they're not going to be great. So I went into a school that didn't care if we were there or not. And me being depressed, I wasn't there. There was no structure. There was one teacher I remember that cared, that even though people were shouting and playing and, you know, causing trouble, would sit with me and be very attentive and, you know, see that I understand he's trying to teach. But unfortunately, it wasn't enough, because I was still depressed and I wasn't happy being in the school. I didn't have the friends that I was used to. So learning fell by the wayside. So, you know, I didn't get the education I wanted, that I should have had. I was very good at it before, and that sort of held me back in life for a very long time. I knew that I wanted to help people, and you wanted to do psychology. But I knew that I didn't have the education, and I knew why. So it was a painful thing, but eventually I went back to uni, and I got my degree, and then I got my postgraduate qualifications over time, later in life, of course. But I knew that I wouldn't have those regrets, that, you know, you regret what you don't do. And it was the thing that would have kept me stuck. And it would have derailed my life. And I see that in people, they're stuck because they haven't overcome something that is holding them in that place. So having been there and done it, I want to sort of show people that whatever it is, you know, it's all in your mind. You have that power, like the strength. You just have to kind of dig deep and find it. And then you can sort of not just survive, but thrive in life, you know.
Yeah. That's a good one. Survive and Thrive. I've had that before on the podcast, Survive and Thrive. And that's kind of like a snapshot there of your thing. And you kind of, you said when you were 13, is it 13 you said, you would take, when you know when you said you were taken away, you're growing up, you're enjoying life. When you say you're taken away, was it like, what was the reasons why? Was it a family reason? Was it just like, you come in and that's it? Or, you know, was a fight put up? You know, what was that like at that time to just say, we're going there?
It was mentioned that, well, we were told that we're going on holiday, all of us. You know, you get to see our country, you know, and you'll enjoy it, and we're going to go for a month. And it was 10 for us, for 3 of us out of 7. And so we were with family that we'd got to know over those months, but, you know, they weren't our family. We didn't know them beyond that. And so it was, I think we kind of very early into that month realized that it wasn't a month. And it's that culture clash. Like, my mom is very traditional, sort of Asian, and she felt like the Western culture was a bad influence. And, you know, she was, I guess, listening to other people. And, you know, she regrets it now. She does. She's apologized since. But, she, you know, at that time, that's what she thought she was doing the best for us. Yeah. As misguided as it was.
I was going to ask you, do you have sisters? And how many, you said there were 7 of you, did you?
7 siblings, yeah.
How many sisters, was it sisters that, was it the girls that she took away, or was it just?
No, all of us went, but the ones that were left were me, my twin sister, and my older brother. He was kind of there to look after us.
You've got a twin sister?
Yeah, yeah.
So you're a twin?
I am, yeah.
Right, now. Now I get it.
What do you
mean? I get the I'm not saying that people who don't have twins can be inquisitive and nature and all, because I'm a twin. My twin died when we was young, you see, so
oh.
I understand now, I can see the twin, right. I kept wondering what is that, and so it's obviously something to do with twin, because a questionable thing, and I get it now. And so she was saying that your mum was saying it was a bad, it, you know, leading up to it, were you angry, were you in fear of going there? And then when did the depression kick in? Was the depression kicked in when you were there and not being able to see you, or was it before that? What was the build up like?
I think when I was there, I was just like, I don't want to be here, you know, I want to go home. It was that kind of sentiment. But because everyone was there, including my mom and the other siblings, you know, it wasn't so bad. It was okay, and we could enjoy things as well. It was kind of after they left, and my older sister, who was back here in the UK, she and I were very close, like, still are. You know, she's like my mom, essentially. And she was, you know, imploring my mum to, like, let us come back, you know, please bring them back. And she even went to our school and told them. She thought they might step in. They didn't. And so they left us as well, and that upset me, and it just became really dire. And I think the depression sort of by month 3 or 4 probably was set in, you know. I just felt quite hopeless and alone, and I didn't know when I'd come back, you know. And then when I got to,
if you come back, or if you'd come back,
yeah, absolutely, yeah. If that was it, it didn't seem like I'd get back, because it just seemed so far away, you you know, a child, you're that far away from your home and your most of your family. It just seemed impossible. Like, will I ever see it again? And I just remember lying in the dark, thinking I wanted to end it, and remembering that the only reason I didn't was because I was religious at the time. You know, and for that I'm grateful to religion, because if it wasn't for that, I don't know if I'd be here.
So that those are, so you're saying there that your twin sister was back in the UK?
No, she and my older brother were there.
You were there, so you both were there, and how did it affect your twin?
I think she dealt with it better than I did. I can't really speak to that too, but I think just based on where life went when we returned, in terms of, like, I kind of just went off the rails. Not as in, like, I didn't do anything, but I guess I didn't do anything, you know, I just, life was derailed for me. Whereas she just kind of got on with things, so I think, and she hasn't really spoken about it the way I have. And so I think she just, it was different.
At the time, did you, I know you're looking at it retrospectively, but at the time, did you feel that, like you said, you wanted to end it, and did you feel at that age, did you know that, I can't kind of put it, you know, so some people are wise enough to know, maybe even at that age, that the symptoms I'm having or the things that I'm having is a depressive state. Did you feel that way, or is it retrospectively looking at it? Did you feel at that time that I am in depression, I'm angry, I'm upset and hurt. Is that the way you felt at that time?
Yeah, I did. I knew that I was depressed, and, you know, and that I would have I would have ended it if I didn't think I would go to hell. I'm not going to end it if I'm going to be in a worse place than this. So, and I believed in God, and, you know, I took strength from religion. So that I can see the value in it, even though I'm agnostic now. I definitely would never knock it. I see its value, and it gives comfort to people. You know, there's reasons for why people believe, and I'll always be grateful for it.
Yeah. And for listeners out there, what's the religion that you were in at that time, or part of, or looked up?
Islam.
So you involved Islam, and you looked at reading the Quran and taking bits and taking things from it to cope, basically, because it was a coping mechanism.
Yeah, it was, in the sense that I didn't necessarily read the Quran, because it's, you know, I never really understood why we were reading it in Arabic, you know, but because I don't understand Arabic. So, you know, I didn't really, I read it in English when I did have to read it in Arabic as well, but in terms of strength from it, it was more my own prayers, you know, lying in bed at night, praying and speaking to this creator, and sort of feeling comforted, and just feeling like there's someone listening. I'm not, you know, you're not on your own.
And were you angry at the time? Were you angry with your mum, or were you angry with, you know, your life? You know, obviously you go in and you're feeling depressed, but was there a lot of anger and resentment at the time?
There was anger, and I think it kind of got worse once I got back, and I couldn't go back to the school that I loved. I couldn't go to this, you know, have the friends that I had. I was in a place, in a school, in a place that they didn't care, and I already felt that. So it was just Yeah, there's anger. But it was, it's that thing, isn't it? Like they say, depression is anger slowed down.
Yeah.
And for me, it felt like it was kind of like an anger that was being pushed down, and it was coming out in sort of a depressive state. And yeah, I guess I wasn't someone who was overly angry, but it was there.
And like you say, you went, did you become like insular? Like when you came back, did you become, because you're not in an environment where you knew people, and did you struggle to find friends? Did you become more insular then, and then even more depressive? Or had the depression kind of subsided because you knew you were back in England, but it was just a change of environment?
Yeah, no, I mean, we did make some friends. Me and my sister, because we were twins and we were in the same year, and so we made friends. But once school finished, I think I started college a couple of times. I dropped out. I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I didn't really have direction then. You know, my dreams from before, they were just kind of lost, and I became a bit more introverted than I was already. I guess a bit reclusive. I didn't go, I stopped studying, and maybe I did some odd jobs, and but really didn't, I wasn't developing socially. And you need to have those experiences to be able to do that.
So the teenage age was quite difficult then for you, in terms of, like you said, communication and socialising with people, and, you know, like you said, you had friends, but the teen, because for both boys and girls, you know, young as and you get to teenage age is as difficult as it is, so that was kind of compounded anyway by the fact that the things that you had gone through and were going through.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, like when I had friends in school and stuff, it was fine, you know, it was cool. But it was just this thing of not feeling like I belonged, and, you know, just kind of being kind of, I wasn't grounded in anything. Because when you're in school, you have to be there, you're sort of, that's what was supposed to ground you, that's your purpose. But once that finishes, if you've kind of been derailed, what is it? What am I supposed to be doing now? And I have to meet people to do that as well. It was just, there was no sort of purpose trajectory for me. So I think what happened was my social skills started to decline from that point, and I became more introverted, and then at one point quite socially anxious as well.
And did anybody notice this, or did you seek help from anybody? And in the long term, you know, was it with teachers at the school, at the college, or anything like that? You know, did you reach out to anybody, or did people notice?
No, I don't think. I mean, people in the family noticed, and they would say things to me. You know, they wanted me to go to school or, like, you know, do something. But beyond that, no. Nobody in college or anything, really.
Yeah. And so then, you become a young lady. What changed for you? What you know, we can't say what changed, because we always stay the same person in a sense, but we make changes to different parts of our personality, because that's why some people say you get to a certain age and, oh, I remember you were just like, you're just the same as you was when you were 9 or whatever. So it never changes in that way, because, you know, we are things, but we things get added to us and taken away, and changes occur, but we, at the core, we're kind of that same person. So what was a moment that made you think to yourself, you know what, what do I need to do? What is my purpose? Was it something someone has said? Was it come? Did it come from religion? Did it come with, or did it come from different parts?
It was actually when I came to a point where I realized I had to stop being angry at my mom, because I felt like that was holding me back. And what was it doing, you know, other than that? It wasn't serving me. It was actually hurting me. And it just reminds me of that quote by Nelson Mandela, something about, what is it? Something about resentment, you know, how it injures us, but, and we expect it to harm our enemies, or something like that. But essentially, I'm drinking poison and expecting someone else to die. And so I, that kind of light bulb moment when I thought, okay, I am angry at her. What she did was wrong, but I understand her more. I do understand her more now that I've studied psychology a bit more. I get that she's a product of her environment. She has her values, her beliefs. She thought she was doing the best. There was no ill intent. It was just unfortunate. And I have to let it go and I have to move on, because I need to be able to thrive. You know, I can't be stuck with this thing that I'm carrying around. It's just weight I need to shed. And so I did. I mentally moved in that direction, and it improved my relationship with her. You know, I'm not kind of holding on to something. And it improved my life prospects. And yeah, it's the turning point. And that's why I feel like in therapy with clients, you know, there's that thing that can be keeping you stuck in a place. And, you know, when I talk to my clients about accepting something, I'm telling them I'm asking them not to say that what happened was okay, because it will never be okay. But that it happened, and now it's about what you want to do. You know, how do you want to respond to that injustice? Do you want to let it? Do you want it to have such far-reaching consequences that it's still with you now and in 20 years' time, or do you want to put a full stop to it here and, you know, achieve some fantastic things?
Yeah, I said it to you earlier. I don't know if you picked up on it, but I mentioned that I said the word resentment, because I knew that there would have been resentment there, and you kind of skipped over it. You kind of went on to other things. You not skipped over it, but you went on to other things, and I realized, and now you've come back to that word. And of course, the you know, as children, and even as adults sometimes, but children, when we've gone through things, and because we don't understand, even in adults, so it's good, unless you get an explanation, you don't understand something. We can hold on to resentment for a long time, and it becomes, and I was going to say the same thing as you said, then it becomes baggage.
I don't know that.
Alexa, please. It becomes resentment and baggage and holding on. As you can see, there's an Alexa there, and yeah, I'm having a three-way conversation. That's never happened before, but yeah. So we do hold on to things a lot, and it can become a heavy weight on us, a heavy weight on our shoulders, and we carry it. And it's not until we look, maybe someone, like you said, if someone says something to us, or something we acknowledge, or we read something, or we see something, and we think, oh, that's what it is. You know, like you said, you had a that moment where you thought, well, what is it? You probably thought for years, what is it? And you thought, you know what, this is my mum. This, I'm holding on to things. And I've had on the podcast before where people have spoken about the parents, and they become, they're a product of their environment, and we've got to change that, you know, in terms of, if it's a negative thing, we've got to change that how we impart that on others, whether it's our kids or whether it's just on ourselves. So our parents might have come from a background where they were being hit, and so do we do that? Do we go then and start hitting a child, or do you know what I mean, or whatever it may be? Do we, you know, they come from an environment where they were shouting, or in their household from their parents, and maybe their grandparents came from even a worse situation. So I've had it on the podcast where people have said, so you know, like similar to you, they've come to realization that they've acknowledged that maybe it's not their, you know, they shouldn't have done this, but you know, maybe it wasn't their fault. And you know, I'm glad that what you're talking about there is that you came to a point where you were, where you didn't hold on to it, because maybe when they pass, you didn't get to reconcile with them. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, I definitely see what you mean there. That would be really sad to have that in my heart, you know, if that happened. But I think one of the things that helped me though to get to that point of letting go of something that wasn't serving me or anybody or anything was the fact that I'd come back to my studies. Like, the thing that I felt was taken away, the thing that was so important to me, wanting to do this work, you know, I you know, that was a regret that I had for years. But then when I went back to education later, and I righted a wrong, you know, I felt like, okay, you know, this wasn't irreversible. I'm doing it. I'm gonna get what, it's a bit later than I would have liked, but I'm still gonna do it, and I'm gonna do what I love. And now I can feel like I can let go of that. And I just think with clients, maybe it has to sometimes happen the other way around, where they don't do the thing that they're being sort of held back from, because they're still in that place of being held. But by helping them to come out of that, maybe then they can do and overcome, you know, and achieve and just feel lighter, you know, feel less burdened, and like you say, have a better relationship, so that when the time comes and that person's no longer around, you know, they won't have an extra thing added in to carry around. But of course there are situations where they won't have that relationship as well, you know, depending on what's happened. But essentially, I just think they shouldn't be left with extra, you know, extra stuff to carry around. It's about helping them to work with what's happened and get them into a place that serves them now, because they shouldn't be held hostage by something that happened to them, to the detriment of the rest of their life.
Yeah. And you kind of had a light bulb moment, and you now got a, you could probably say, a spring in your step. You wanting to do things, and you're wanting to you know, you got your studies, you're writing, and what was, when you passed the courses and you and you graduated, can you remember what it felt like, that moment of, I've passed and I'm going to be this, and did you ever think back and think, you know what, I've come a long way to, from that moment then to now, I've come a long way. Kind of give us that kind of, that the thoughts and your how you felt, and you know, the you must have felt proud, and the parents felt proud and all that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so grateful for the Open University. I just have to shout out to it, because, you know, it helped me to get to where I'm at now.
Yeah.
It led on to other university courses as well,
yeah,
like the brick universities, but it was the thing that helped me, and I achieved a first class as well.
Right.
So it wasn't just a pass, you know.
I was
doing something that I was really passionate about, that was way overdue, and I was just so grateful to, you know, get back on the track, but not just pass, but surpass, you know, my own expectations of myself. And it actually made me feel vindicated, because you lose a lot of confidence along the way when this kind of stuff happens. You start to doubt your abilities. You start to think, maybe I'm not smart enough to do that. Maybe I'm not, you know, I'm not capable. And your self-esteem really suffers. And, you know, that adds to that social anxiety. It's all intertwined. And so by achieving what I felt initially I was able to achieve, you know, back in the early days when I thrived at school, I felt vindicated. I felt like, oh, actually, you know, I can do it. I could always do it. It wasn't, you know, I noticed that it was a loss of confidence, not ability, you know. And so when I graduated, it was like, I don't know, it just meant so much to me. If it meant more than what it might to some people, I don't know. There was so much weight to that thing. There was so much about that thing that I was being held back from, that now I felt like something in life that was wrong had been righted. And it could have gone one way, which, you know, it very could have gone in that direction. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. I would be probably needing therapy myself, right? But I'm able to do what I do, you know, work with people to see them transform like I did.
Yeah.
And that's just...
So you've overcome, you know, an adversity and hurdles and even during the course would have been hard for you because of the lack of education, like you've said, or the lack of
learning. But also I had to work while I was studying, because I wasn't doing it at the age I'm supposed to be doing it, when you don't have to work.
You got to a stage where you was doing both things, so even then it's taken on a for all the things you've been through and having to work and the things that you're going through, maybe even sometimes you probably thought about giving up and all sorts of things, and even the learning processes, you've achieved a massive thing. You know, you've achieved, you can say, when people say greatness, you often associate greatness with things, but that's a great thing that you've achieved because of the things that you've been through. And like you said, it could have gone the other way. The door could have swung away, and you could have not achieved this, and you could be in Kashmir and not, you know, you could have been there now and not achieved anything, and who knows? So, you know, and also, like you say, you could have gone so far the road of depression, and you said you've always wanted to help people, and do you think this, you overcoming this, as even enhanced that thing of you wanting to help people?
That's a really good question. I always strongly felt like I wanted to help people. And when I've looked at it, because, you know, as we train, we reflect a lot. I've self-reflected and, you know, I've thought, I was kind of pushed into this helper role as a child. So maybe that's why my strengths lie in that and why I'm so inclined towards it. But I think it was more than that. I think it's genetic as well. I think, you know, if we go back in our ancestors, our lineage, and there are going to be those people that might have been like the community sort of leader or, you know, advisor or whatever, you know, that was there to like listen and help people work things out. And I feel like there was something in me that was just very much suited to this kind of work. And then having gone through what I've gone through as well, I definitely think that's strengthened it, because I've had to overcome my own battles internally, you know. I've had to overcome and do things in the world to get to this point, to that shows the human spirit to me.
Yeah.
So I believe in it. You know, I can vouch for that. It's not like something that I've read about. It's so, I'm so convicted about that thing. And how can I help someone do something like this if I don't even know if it's possible myself?
Yeah.
But I do know.
Yeah.
And that's why that carries me through. You know, when I'm talking to people and I'm listening to them, I'm coming from a place where I'm trying to impart something from a place of complete and utter conviction. And it's like, I've said this before, you know, say for instance, I've had a client who's had CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy in the NHS, and she came to me and she said, I don't want to do that, I hate it. And I said to her, well, if I feel like it might be useful at points, can I just bring it up to you and see what you think? And then we'll work with it if you'd like to. Because it's very different to what you've had in the NHS. It's a different version, essentially. And it's also because I believe in CBT. I believe, you know, I've done a lot of research around CBT. I believe in its efficacy, and I'm going to bring it to you in a way that might be different, and then you might buy into it as well.
Yeah.
Right. So I think as long as what we're doing, we believe in what we're doing, we have to do that. If we don't, why should anyone believe in it? And so I think, you know, just like I said, just knowing that we're capable of so much, I want to tap into the potential and, you know, actualize. That's what we all should be doing all the time.
Yeah. And during your journey, particularly after the light bulb moment, was there anybody that helped you on the way, or was it kind of just your journey? You know, obviously, you know, sometimes humans say, oh, you know, I don't want any help, or you know, but we all have, sometimes it may be someone on the way who said something on that journey, someone on that path that said something, or, you know, touched our hearts in a certain way, or whatever it may be, gave us a pat on the shoulder or whatever. Was there anybody that kind of helped you on the way during university? And also another thing as well, for people out there that are struggling with social anxiety, how were you able to overcome that by going into the university after Open University?
I think along the way I had my husband. He was, you know, helping me and supporting me. And at one point then I didn't have to work, I could just study, you know, focus on that,
yeah.
Which was fantastic. Also, you know, like my sister, I'd send her my draft essays to just read and give me feedback, and it was just so great to have like such positive feedback from her. And just like she told me she's proud of me, and you know, like I said, she's like my mum almost. Like she it just felt so good to hear that from her, and because, you know, I value her opinion. And so there was that side of it. And in terms of the social anxiety, once I don't know, I think it was that kind of gradually shifted along the way, just in a subtle way. I think by the time I went to Brick University, it wasn't quite as bad by any means.
Yeah.
Because I guess I'd started to get back my confidence just from the feedback and the marking and all of that, and just feeling indicated, and just like it was where I belonged now. I found it.
And have you since then have you found that we go through life, things happen to us, and you know, like you say, the last 2 years, and just, you know, sometimes we not have a bad day. Do you ever find yourself slipping back, but kind of thinking another way, but then you have to pull yourself back, you know, like you know, we do, we go through days when we're angry or whatever, and we have to kind of pull ourselves away and think, you know what, you know, I need to kind of draw back and take a step back and kind of like this is that goes back to that thing, isn't it? When you're angry, you take 10 seconds to think and calm yourself and just things like that. Have you ever found yourself drawing back into how you felt before and then you've had to pull yourself back?
I have at times, because sometimes you experience sort of power dynamics in places as well.
Yeah.
That can be very stressful, and it can affect your esteem. And that's happened to me at university, or two even, and that. That was difficult because it's that thing of being tapped down, you know, and put in a box. And, you know, if you're not conforming to what we expect you to be, then you're a problem. And so that was stressful and difficult. But actually, the most recent time when something happened was when I got COVID, had it once, and I remember it did affect my mood in a way that I didn't expect. I did feel a little bit apathetic about life. Kind of wondered, you know, what... You just kind of feel a little bit like you ask those questions, you know, what is this about? And that kind of thing. But I actually noticed it, and at the time I said to myself, this is COVID, you know, I'm not well, I've probably been overworking before this, and I just need to get well and then let's see how I feel.
Yeah.
And it was that, because once I was back, you know, I was okay, I wasn't asking those questions, I was, you know, enjoying what I was doing again.
Human being, as a someone who's, as you know, psychologist and therapist. Now you can call yourself a therapist, or you see clients. Do you feel, because what do you do for yourself? What do you do for yourself to make you happy, the person that you? Because we often said that we cannot make others happy if we're not. We cannot make someone feel, we can, but they often say that if you're not feeling your 100%, how can you make others feel, you know, it's about that glass half empty and all that sort of stuff. And if your battery's not, because the analogy of your battery's not, you know, go back to mobile phones, if your battery's not full, how are you going to be able to send someone a message? You know, if it's draining, how do you keep yourself topped up? How do you keep yourself the battery charged? What are the things that you do as a person outside of work to kind of keep yourself happy and keep yourself, it could be cooking or whatever it may be, what do things do you, the sort of things that you do?
I love to see my family, you know, whenever I get that time in an evening, if I can, I make sure I do it at least once a week. Because whenever I get to get, so with them, I've got nieces and nephews as well.
Yeah.
It's like there's all of us there. It's a big family. We, you know, we can just have a laugh. We can connect. We eat together. It's little moments like that that are important. You know, it's human connection, and it can easily get lost nowadays with busy lives and, you know, commitments and things. But when we're in, you know, we are social creatures, and we release oxytocin, which is a feel-good hormone when we are in connection. If we don't have opportunities where we can release those hormones, we're depleting ourselves of those hormones. That's going to affect mood and everything else. So if I'm not doing those things, I'm not really useful to anyone else, like especially my clients. I have to look after myself first, to make sure that I can look after others in the capacity that I'm, you know, charged with. And that's what I also ask my clients to do, the ones that are always putting other people before them,
yeah,
to their own detriment. and they're suffering. They're suffering with it. And these other people that they help don't necessarily notice it. So it's like I try to bring it back to them, and I have to practice that too. So I make sure I read as well. I enjoy reading and learning. I do like to cook when I have time. I like PlayStation as well, but since I bought the PS5, I haven't actually played it. Yeah. So
what's your game to play on the PS5 or the PS?
Dark Souls and Bloodborne and like the From Software games. They've released a new one, but I haven't actually played it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've not heard anyone on the podcast mention that yet. So you're the first person to mention playing on the PlayStation.
And what's your game?
I don't really play PlayStation, but I do play Fortnite at the odd time, and because the kids at school have got me into it, and someone did say to me that working with children, even with working adults, but when you work, again, you'll probably find that if you're working with clients, but particularly children, because they're so energy, and I spoke to you about we are energy, and if you put it in like in a cartoon format or whatever, but if you imagine these balls of energy firing at you all day. And you're this one solid, and you're this one energy, firing at your day. And by the time you get home, you can feel them on you. You can feel this ball of energy on you. You can feel, sir, mister, you know, all day. And so what happens is you just want to take off my clothes and see. And what someone said to me is that sometimes, you know, doing things like playing on the PlayStation can be it's an opportunity for you to unwind. Some people have, I mean, I don't drink alcohol, I've never smoked drugs, I've never taken weed or whatever, you know, marijuana, I've never done any of those things, I don't have alcohol, so what's my thing to unwind? So sometimes I might play on the PlayStation, sometimes I might, like say, read or whatever, and so, and I suppose you have the similar thing, those things that kind of help you to kind of unwind and separate yourself from what you might see as your clients.
It's true, and it's especially important now that we work in our homes as well. Like, we do need that transition thing to come, like, separate work and home.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it just, the work bleeds into the rest of your life, and then you're just kind of, like you say, depleted, you know? So, I do need to pick up the PlayStation a bit, though, because it's
and, so do you do things and do you do things for yourself, like are you a person that does the reason why I'm asking this as well, because a lot of the people listening would want to know, what does a person who works with others do to unwind, and you know, do you set yourself time for relaxing baths and saunas and chill moments, and is that what you find for yourself as a human being?
Yes, there's two things that I realised that I absolutely need for self-care. One is exercise, and that includes, you know, strength training, cardio, as well as yoga. Because yoga is moving meditation, and it's like, you know, you're connecting the breath with the movement, and it relaxes your mind while you do that. You're just focusing on the breathing, and that's like something I can bring into therapy as well. And that's one thing that grounds me. And another thing is my sleep. I have to make sure that I get good sleep.
Yeah.
You know, there's been times when I haven't done that, and I've noticed it, and I want to be, you know, on top form cognitively for my clients, and emotionally as well. Like, I need to be able to, I need to have those reserves there, and if I'm tired, and if I'm not looking after myself, I can't be on top form. And I would be dissatisfied with that. And that's why I make sure that I make sure I get my sleep, I make sure I do my exercise and I see my family, and those, you know, I get those feel good hormones from all of those activities. It keeps me in sort of good stead mentally, emotionally, physically, and it's the kind of thing that I can say to clients as well, because I'm doing it.
You know, you're obviously in a better place than you was. You know, you like you say, you're able to do play on your PlayStation, play games, do all these things. You're in a better place mentally than you were all those years ago. And like you say, it's been, you know, the things that you've achieved and you are achieving, because you, even by helping others, you are achieving your goals or your aims or whatever it may be, the things that you wanted to do in life. For the listeners out there, I want you to kind of big yourself up. What, you know, kind of tell me, because people might want to contact you, and where can you be found? You know, are you your new practice and everything like that? What, tell, in fact, just big yourself up.
Okay, I'll try. Affinity Therapy is our practice. That's what it's called. It comes from our brand animal, which is the dolphin,
right.
Because the dolphin, I've always loved the dolphin. It's playful, it's curious, it's intelligent, but it's so connected as well. It cares, and there's been stories of dolphins helping humans, and they're family oriented, you know. So that's where the name came from, and we live, breathe therapy, and what it means, we're coming back to what it should be. It's been politicized, you know, it's been affected by sort of budgets and sort of political demands and that kind of thing. It's not necessarily fit for purpose when that happens. It, of course, it does help people, but we're kind of bringing it back to you, you know, the client, the human being in front of us. And we're in central Birmingham, but we do online therapy as well. If you can't get here, we have people across the country. Our website's being made right now, but at some point it will be out there. You can Google us, because we are out there. We do have a presence online. But we just want to carry on doing this great work.
Yeah, so say the name again.
It's Finity Therapy. So it's Phinity.
And that's you've got a website, which is .com.
The website will be .com, but at this time it's being developed, but you can find us on.
Are you anywhere else? Are you on Instagram or Facebook?
Yeah.
Or something like that, so you can be found on there as
well. Yeah, we're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Yeah.
And Instagram is the same handle?
Yes, yes.
Right, okay. So, you know, it's been, I was going to say, before I say, you know, it's been good. It's been nice having you on and talking to you. It's a bit about dolphins and dolphins. What, there's something I've read where it said that dolphins help with childbirth, can help with childbirth. Because when dolphins come to a child in the water, a baby, they're actually talking to them. They don't attack them or anything like that, but they can actually talk to them. And also, when a woman's pregnant, when a dolphin comes, it's a woman's in the thingy. And because it's something to do with the sonar signals that they give off. And what happens is they've said that babies can actually, or children can learn to speak better and quicker having connected with a dolphin. And that's a true fact. So look that one up.
That's actually really beautiful, and it ties into something I read once that I don't know if it's a fact, but it sounds great that they can see the child in the womb, you know, like an ultrasound, because of the way their vision is, and that could explain how they're quite helpful in that situation, actually.
I read that.
But this is why I love them.
Yeah, I read that the other day, and that's the reason why they're so playful, because they're not harmful animals, and there's something to do with the sonar. They can pick up signals, and like you say, with the baby in the room and pregnancy, they can actually connect with babies. So it's you're onto a winner there.
Thank you. Yeah, it's just, it's our identity, it's what we believe, you know, we want to embody that kind of, that sentiment of the dolphin, because it's so beautiful.
And before you go then as well, can you give anybody out there that may be struggling with depression or something, just give them a couple of lines, a line or so of inspiration, something that they can, you know, they can leave, they can take away from this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say that if anyone is out there and they're struggling, there will be. This is where you are now. It doesn't have to be where you stay. You know, you can move into a different space. You can get help. You're not on your own. There are people out there, even if you don't have family or friends, there are people out there who can help you to go into that place where you want to be and where you deserve to be. So I just want to say, don't give up on yourself. You know, don't listen to that voice that is telling you to give up. Try to listen to that other one that might sound faint, but it is there. And it will get louder the more you listen to it. So just get the help, get the support, and, you know, visualize the future that you want, because you have it within you to achieve anything that you want to achieve. So just go for it and get the help to guide you along the way.
Yeah. And that's it. Thank you. And for the listeners out there, there's one point where they won't see it because obviously it's not video format, but there's one bit where I forgot what you said and you went like that. You kind of went like that. And that was a sign that, yes, you know, you've got to the place where I forgot what it was you said, but it's something you said and you went like this. And I remember it when I listened back, and I thought, yes, she's got to a place where she's achieved a lot, and she's kind of, yes, I've made it. So, but yeah, I'd like to say thank you for coming on and to kind of giving us insight into what you do. I mean, I would like to invite you back on again, maybe to talk about some of the certain things that certain aspects of it. So it may be what is social anxiety, it might be, you know, what is depression, it might be any sort of thing that you've kind of picked up on today, to kind of let the listeners know that it's different for everybody, but these are the cues, or these are the things, and what can you do to help it. So I'd like to say thank you for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Andy. And again, you know, I think what you're doing is so amazing. It's so good to see people like you in the world as well. And I just want to say thank you for inviting me, and I'd love to come.
Yeah. And that was Men Are Nuts. Speak to you soon.